Coming to you from our studios in Dallas, Texas, and recorded live, Science News is on the air right now.
This is the promise of tomorrow, where people and industry keep up with the business of emerging and nanotechnologies. The fields covered in this series of programs will include energy, defense, aerospace, medicine, semiconductors, and more. For the next hour, Colonel Mason will introduce his experts, and you'll be on the cutting edge of the promise of tomorrow.
And once again, we really, really do appreciate you joining us as we explore the exciting world of the business of emerging science, nanotechnology, and open innovation. Today, we're going to visit with Brian Miller. He's the president and founder of NanoLab Technologies, a privately held company that he started a number of years ago when he broke loose from a bigger organization. And we're going to get to kind of track how he did it and how he branched out on his own and is making a pretty good living in the field of nanotechnology. And I'm sure you're going to find that very interesting. And, of course, we're going to visit the Den of Strangers, get more wisdom from somebody a lot of us never heard of, and visit our fountain of useless information we have here on the set of the second half of the program. And, of course, at the end of the program, listener comments and the voice of reason. Right now, though, before we step into our busy newsroom and get some headline news in the world of science, we want to check in with our lead story. Clayton Teague told us that venture capitalists and people with money better get used to the idea of not getting a fast turnaround on their investment when they invest in nanotechnology. Now, he doesn't think it's a bad thing, but he thinks it's a matter of realism. And he is speaking about commercialization of nanotechnology at the 11th International Conference on Nanotechnology. That's the traveling conference that goes all over the world. And is going to be, we're lucky we have it in Portland, Oregon, August 15th through the 18th. It's the flagship IEEE conference in nanotechnology. And he's going to be speaking there on commercialization. So let's get right to our lead story, and that's getting used to the longer turnaround when you're going to invest in the very bright field of nanotechnology. So right now to our lead story, let's check in with Clayton Teague, former director of the National Nanotechnology Coordinating Office. Well, we recognized for a long time that with nanotechnology, commercialization is the key, because if that happens, we've got a lot of private money that is eager to get into it. And one of the biggest problems has been the venture capitalists wanting a faster turnaround than the nanotechnology startup companies have been able to give. Do you see that changing soon?
I don't know. I think sometimes a lot of investors look at nanotechnology and maybe with somewhat the same expectations they had for information technology.
Mm-hmm.
But there's quite a bit of difference between information technology, which is dealing with ideas, certainly the implementation and software, but implementation and software is much different from implementation and real stuff in when you're dealing with real materials and things of that nature. It's quite a different demands and length of times of investigation and research and development when you're dealing with real materials versus just ideas and concepts and software. So the turnaround time is from concept to real implementation and commercialization, I think, is should not be expected in under 10 to 15 years, which is certainly a lot longer than one, I think, a lot of times had expected in with so many of the rapid transitions that happened in IT. And so I think that the length of time is going to be hard to shorten very much, because it just by the nature of things with real materials and real devices, the length of time to bring from concept to real first prototyping and then finally into real commodity production is just longer.
That's a very interesting comment, and I'm very glad to hear you say that you shared that with us, because that's certainly something that we get questioned about all the time on this program. Yeah, the states, a lot of the states are very active, as we know. In New York is one of them, California, Oregon, Texas, a number of places. And speaking of Oregon, I understand you're going to be the keynote speaker at the 11th International Conference on Nanotechnology, August 15th through the 18th in Portland, and we're going to look forward to seeing you there. And have you figured out yet exactly what you're going to cover in that talk?
Well, As indicated by your conversation with Dr. Morris, the two subjects we had talked about would be the one efforts on the federal efforts on commercialization, mm-hmm. to help with commercialization, and to address and discuss what's happening in the whole area of environmental health and safety. Those are the two primary topics that we had discussed and will likely be the focus of that.
Well, Dr. Teague, I know that if you, you've listened to the program, so you know that we've got a little thing on it we call the Voice of Reason, where we try to get a bit of wisdom from one of the guests from time to time, and we kind of put it in the can, and we bring him back at different times. And I wonder, is there some lesson that you learned late in life you wish you would have learned earlier, or some bit of advice you might give somebody that wants to get into the nanotechnology business, or career advice you would give to a student or something? What is a favorite little lesson you'd like to leave with us today?
I guess one of the key ones would be to not limit yourself. If I was speaking to a young researcher, I would say to not limit yourself on your ideas and to really pursue ideas to the fullest, and to let the limitation only be your efforts and your will to make it happen. And because it's so easy sometimes to argue yourself out of ideas, and my encouragement would be to the young researchers to pursue their ideas as far as they possibly can, and only let it be limited by their own efforts. That would be the primary one. And as far as things like the NNCO and the overall nanotechnology initiative, I think that I've said many times in my discussions with the NSET subcommittee and other people associated with the nanotechnology initiative that I was continually impressed with the huge capabilities that are within the federal government, and that the capabilities that the government has, if it can be pulled together and worked in a harmonious way across all the agencies, are just huge. And I think every effort such as the NNI that can be exploited to really have all the agencies pull together toward common targets, there's just a vast potential within the federal government. Sometimes one of the ways in which it's being realized is through the NNI, but I think sometimes it's unfortunately not realized as much as it could be.
Well, Dr. Clayton Teague, former director after 8 years of the National Nanotechnology Coordination Office, your generous giving of your time is deeply appreciated by all of us in the audience and your fans everywhere, and we wish you just the happiest of retirement, and we look forward to seeing you in Portland, Oregon in August at the 11th Annual Nanotechnology Conference. And thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, thank you.
All right, well, let's step over here a minute and get into our busy and noisy world newsroom, where we get news from all over the place. News clips, we call it, and it's because what happens is the news moves in, we used to say over the wire, but now I guess we'd have to say over the air. And when it moves in our printers, our reporters will look and see something that looks interesting and clip it. And so that we can go back over and look at these clips and figure out what we're going to do for a new news story. We get asked all the time where we get our news from. So let's look at the clips and see what we have. Lord Ray from the House of Lords says that the Climate Change Act in the UK should be repealed, carbon budgets abandoned, and all the agencies such as the Climate Change Committee sent packing. That's a quote. And he says that the bad economic area, you know, in climate in London, that this will give it a chance to get their economy to resurrect itself. Otherwise, he says, we have a grim and very likely dim future. So that's Lord Ray saying that he doesn't like the Climate Change Act. And Holger Cromer reports that the climate policy of the European Union is now stuck at a dead end. He says Europe wanted to be the leader, showing the world the way. It wanted to export the market economic instruments of emissions trading as a new standard of regulation. But today it's clear, he says, there's going to be no successor agreement to Kyoto. There's no way out of the dilemma, he says. Europe is completely standing alone. The world is not a carbon market. It never will be, he contends. And, of course, you've heard that Germany plans to do away with all their nuclear power plants in a dozen years or so because of the recent catastrophes in Japan. But there's concern that it can't do it because power is going to just cost too much. And they point out that Germany isn't subject to earthquakes and tsunamis as Japan is, and so Germany doing away with all of its nuclear power plants might be a big mistake. Well, look at this. IBM jumps big hurdles in its phase change memory development. Phase change memory uses the resistance change that occurs when a material changes state to store bits. And it's been heralded as a potential replacement for flash memory, but it's been hampered by reliability. Well, now, for the first time, IBM research scientists have demonstrated that the ability to store multiple data bits per cell, and they've done it 100 times faster than flash memory can. Well, I don't think we ought to get too excited. Their new chip is fast and durable, but it's costly and potentially will not scale very well in the next generation of chips. And, of course, it won't be affordable down the road. They contend, and flash memory, as we know, is much cheaper. Here's an interesting item. NASA, the National Institute for Health, the National Science Foundation, and the USDA in partnership? They're combining forces to fast-track the development and use of co-robots in the United States that work cooperatively with people, with us. So we're going to have robots all over the place working cooperatively with us if this goes through. They're saying a solicitation for proposals for the next they're calling it the National Robotics Initiative, NRI, has been released along with the establishment of the Advanced Manufacturing Partnership. And it's reporting here that investments in NRI may reach $50 million in the first year. Okay. Well, in keeping with what we like to do here at this program, we're going to continue to talk today about nanotechnology and the different things going on with it. And I want to introduce you to a friend of mine, Brian Miller. He's got a lot of experience as product management for capital equipment in the semiconductor and research institutions. And he's president and founder of Nanolab Technologies. Welcome to the program, Brian.
Thank you, Carl. I think I have an airplane going over my head right now. Hopefully that's not too loud.
Can't hear it. No, I didn't hear the airplane, Brian. But tell us a little bit about yourself. When did you decide that you wanted to work in the fields of nanotechnology?
I graduated in physics, so I guess it relates back to that time. And then after graduating physics, I went to FEI for. Did applications and then went into product management. And then after FEI, I just, the best opportunity was to make one for myself, which was set up a rep company and provide these tools that go on to mainly onto SEMs and dual beam systems. So you know, it's been about 17, 18 years now, and having fun.
So you decided you wanted to be a sales engineer in the field of nanotechnology and be an independent and not work for anybody else. Was it difficult getting your company off the ground?
Yeah, I think it's always a little bit challenging when you go from a regular paycheck to surviving on your own. But you know, these were good companies, and it actually worked out very nicely. And I spread my income out by doing training for people, and also for installs and service for both Bruker and OmniProbe. So I sell the tools, install them, and do the training for them.
Well, that's really cool. That's really cool. I mean, that our listeners are certainly going to be interested in that. Who did you go to first? Was Bruker your first client, or who was the first one that you you went and knocked on the door and said, "I want a rep for you"?
That would be actually Bruker, XCI, and OmniProbe. They all happened probably within a week of each other.
Wow. And how did you do it? All of a sudden, one day, you just decided, well, look, I want to work for myself. I'm going to go see if there's any interest in being a rep for these companies. And none of them wanted an exclusive. They didn't want you to be the exclusive rep. They didn't mind that you were going to be brokering for other organizations, too?
Oh, yeah. No, so I have exclusivity with them in that I have a territory, and sell into that territory. But reps need multiple sources of income, so none of my clients would expect me to just sell just for them. Right? So I get the advantage of cross-selling across product lines. So I focus on systems that are going into laboratories, generally with SEMs in them. And so since I can cross-market things, it's advantageous for my clients and for my principals. And since I understand the equipment and do the installs, it works out very nicely. The OmniProbe was a company I worked with through my previous employment at FTR. So I was very familiar with them. I knew the owner there. And so when I left FEI, it was an obvious person to contact and discuss working with. And then the other ones kind of came to me through recommendations of other people. I mean, it's always good to keep up your contacts with people, you know, because you never know where things are going to go in life, right?
Yeah, I guess so. And this kind of makes you the specialist. I mean, you go in and find out the particular problems that a company has, and you can maybe offer multitude of solutions depending upon which is the most handy. Is that the case?
Oh yeah, absolutely. So I always like to start off with, you know, listening to what the customer does, and then once you know, I've learned what they're doing and where problems are. I can recommend things that either fit in my product line, or if there's things I've heard of outside of that would also be helpful. Because, you know, quite often a customer will mention something and I'll know someone else that's repping something that I think is pretty interesting, regardless of whether I sell it or not. So it's always good to provide that in service to the customer also.
Yeah, well, your territory is the Northwest, I understand, and that has been quite a hotbed in recent years with the technology that's going on in the Northwest. But I hear every once in a while that there's been some distress out there. What do you see for the future for that area?
Well, I think it's growing quite a bit. You know, 2008 was obviously a very slow year in 2009, but 2010 and 11 have moved along very nicely. So I cover Pacific Northwest in the U.S. and in Canada, and I'm still seeing a lot of things going on in growth in both in British Columbia and in Alberta. So that's also nice to see. And Oregon's been very consistent, and there's a lot of things going on with energy research in Washington and Idaho, and new things coming up in Montana. So it's, things are going pretty good.
That's interesting. I didn't know that you repped in Canada, too. So how much of your time do you spend in Canada versus here in the States?
Well, I live in the United States. Most of my time is spent in Portland, Oregon. And then road trips, you know, I'll drive all the way to Edmonton, Alberta, which is quite far away. But I usually go up to Canada 3 or 4 times a year.
Okay, and you see the business growing in Canada too. Then I take it. Is that right?
Oh, absolutely. A lot more mining stuff, but also more semiconductor type ideas, microfluidics and NEMS type stuff. There seems to be a particular interest to them.
Well, does that, you know, I mean, where do you see your business going? Are you going to add more lines and more organizations that you're going to rep, or do you think that the increased business with the ones you currently have are going to keep you busy enough?
Well, I probably will only take on a couple more. I think if you get too saturated with too many items, then, you know, you can't get to the point where you understand what your products are. You got to keep a decent line carpet for one to get 2 days. So that's the basic strategy.
Well, this 11th International Conference on Nanotechnology being produced August the 15th to the 18th in Portland is the flagship IEEE conference in nanotechnology, and it moves around. But you're probably not going to be moving with it when they have it next year in Birmingham, England. You're gonna have to stay right where you are in the Northwest. Is that right?
Yeah, that would be very true. I only rep in that territory I specified. So UK is outside of that area. Although I do keep in touch with reps out there, and if for some reason they. Most of the companies I have do business out there too. So if there was anybody at IEEE that visited any of my clients, I would be referred to them.
Okay, Brian Miller, the president and founder of Nanolab Technologies. It's fun to hear how a guy, a lone guy, breaks from a major company, 16 or so years ago, and starts his own operation with the bumps that you've run into, and how you've managed to make a good living in the field of nanotechnology. That's going to be pretty fascinating to a lot of our listeners. And when we come back in the second half hour, we're going to want to ask you some questions about some of the companies that you represent and some of the triumphs and disappointments and things that you've run into. So that's going to come up in the second hour when we get back to you. And, of course, we'll also visit our fountain of useless information in the second half hour. And at the end of the program, listener comments and the voice of reason. All right now it's time to take a break. Okay. As we walk to the break at the half hour, we're going to pause at the door of the Den of Strangers, where we keep locked away all of the wisdom of mankind. In the Den of Strangers will we meet today?
Yes, I say we'll have a bit of a go of it. Arthur Clark. That would be Sir Arthur Clark. And Clark is Clark with an E. There are three things that have come to be known as Clark's Law. Number one, when a distinguished but elderly scientist states that something is possible, he is almost certainly right. When he states that something is impossible, he is very probably wrong. Number two, the only way of discovering the limits of the possible is to venture a little way past them, into the impossible. And number three, any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic.